what a wonderful introduction. And to think he wears shoes and I didn't wear jeans. I dressed for Louisville. I didn't come from, I thought I came from California and I could dress down, but apparently I decided in Louisville you should do as folks do, except I'm a sissy drinker, so I don't drink bourbon. I drink California wine. What I would like to do tonight is something slightly different than what the society has done in the past, and that is to invite the audience to ask questions and to participate. The reason why I think this is, and the leadership, El Jefe Grande, agreed, is that we're sufficiently homogeneous and tight enough in this room that I think we can all be heard and have a chat. And there's nothing quite so, it seems to me, tiring after dinner than to hear somebody speak. And I'll tell you, from my perspective, to see somebody nod off in the audience, that's really a bit much. So what I thought I'd do, drinks are at the anti-federalist demand that drinks are at 9. Is that correct? So I will talk for about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, then open it up to you folks, and you can ask me whatever you wish to concerning the founding. The title, Why Keep the Anti-Federalists Alive, is inspired in part by our dear friend of many, many years for all of us, George Carey, who about 5 to 6 years ago wrote a piece called Who Killed the Philadelphia Constitution? A very optimistic piece for George these days. And as a Welsh West Indian immigrant who sees hope in America, I wasn't willing to accept the fact that the Philadelphia Constitution that I've spent so many months on and have a website that's first on Google is dead. So I figured that, George, with all due regard, I thought that I would challenge you that it is not dead. Other folks have asked the question, well, who hijacked the Philadelphia Constitution? And George remarks about killing it was that there's political parties, and the folks who've written about hijacking, it says it's progressives. Well, I'm not so sure that it's, but if the progressives hijacked it, it was done constitutionally, which provides us with a bit of a problem. But so the first point I want to make is in effect that why we want to keep the anti-federalists alive is because we want to keep the Constitution alive. And I know that sounds a bit odd because we often think that the anti-federalists were losers and the Constitution is a testimony to their inadequacy. But what I'm trying to suggest is that the hijacking or the killing of the Constitution moves not from the anti-federalist objections, but from some kind of deranged fulfillment of the Federalist Papers themselves. And that what we need to do is to return to the founding, to return to the conversation, and realize the value that the anti-federalists have, the value that they have for us today. And My approach is really very, very simple. I don't go back to teach James Madison something or Richard Henry Lee something. I go back for James Madison or Richard Henry Lee to teach me something. And because I don't think that the current generation has all the answers. And so I think I think the founders can teach us something. And the other reason why I think we should not only keep the anti-federalists alive is because they're in the Constitution. I mean, this idea that the anti-federalists weren't part of the conversation and sort of lost and were could be put in the dustbin of history precisely because they lost is misplaced. They're in the Constitution, and currently, three places that are in the Constitution where we need to remind ourselves is, one, there is still albeit very difficult to recognize, there is still a listing of powers. And I know it's all stretched and whatnot, but still there's a listing of powers. Secondly, there is a Senate in which the states are still represented. True that the state legislatures do not elect the senators, but the Senate is still there, and the Electoral College is still there. What is absolutely fascinating is if George is correct that the Philadelphia Constitution is who killed it, it's dead, and other people are saying it's been hijacked, there are sure a lot of liberals out there who want to kill it further, who think that it still has life in it, and that there are folks like Larry Sabato who's not usually known for his left-wing politics. They're all after the Electoral College. They're all after the unfairness of the Senate. It's amazing that this sort of critique is still going on in the 21st century. And what it all has to boil down to is this: they want to remove whatever vestiges of anti-federalism are still in the Constitution. Madison was not a big devotee of Senate. The equality of the states in the Senate. He was not a big devotee of listing powers. He was not a big devotee of the Electoral College. Those three elements, which I've just listed, are in fact part of the anti-federalist disposition at the founding, to write things down and to secure what I might call democratic federalism. That is the notion that you cannot popular government without having some kind of secure, decentralized political culture. And you're not going to have that kind of political culture unless there is a secure spot within the overall Constitution for the states. So if you're going to be like Sabato or Levinston, who are going to argue that the Constitution is unfair because you've got 53, I'll say this really straightforward, 53 odd Californians in the House, and then you have two odd Californians in the Senate, but you only have two not so odd Alaskans in the Senate, and why should it be that the folks from Alaska should be equally represented with the folks from California? Well, I mean, having lived in California for so long, I think the answer is obvious. But on the other hand, we're not just talking about some kind of rational approach to, in the sense that fairness is only about numbers. Fairness has also to deal with regionalism or ethnicity or. Those factors have to be taken into account. So part of my current project is to resist these end runs which are going on by various sensible people to try to end the Electoral College and to end the Senate representation on the grounds that it is out of date with the 21st century, and B, is unfair with regard to the nature of the American regime, which gets me to the point, why keep the anti-federalists alive? Because they are the advocates and defenders of decentralization. They are the people who say you cannot have democracy and nationalism together. You can only have democracy and some degree of federalism. That is, to think that you can have 300 million people in one democracy with one rule fitting all is ludicrous. The only way in which you can do that is by having the administrative state, which is what the progressive agenda calls for, which is built on the Federalist Papers, by the way, not necessarily a natural fulfillment, but it doesn't come out of the anti-federalist tradition. And so you need this kind of democratic federalism, this kind of security for local politics, which is the sine qua non of democratic life. You cannot have this abstract proposition that one rule fits all. That's, to me, the anti-federalist heritage with regard to what I call democratic federalism. Another reason we need to revive the anti-federalists or keep them alive is because they are alive already. And I realize there are a whole bunch of historians and political scientists who've declared them to be dead or irrelevant. They associate them with the Articles of Confederation, and we all know how imbecile that was. That's right, they only defeated the British. The bird still tweeted, the wheat still grew. I mean, maybe it was Hamilton and his urge for glory that was part of the problem. The other problem with rescuing the anti-federalists or retrieving them is that they've been often associated with sort of a proto-secessionist movement. That there's a straight line from the anti-federalists to Calhoun to secession by way of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, which I have to mention because we all know Bill Campbell tries to stretch as far as he can a theme with a place. And so we're here in Louisville, and we have to come up with the theme, and the theme is, oh, this is where the Kentucky resolutions take place. Oh, and that deals with anti-federalism. Oh, there's Gordon Lloyd, and oh, here I am. So we have to be able to make that kind of association. but I want to... It's not that I want to challenge El Jefe Grande on this question, but I think we need to realize that perhaps the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions are more part of the founding than they are part of this proto-secession, that somehow Jackson or other people appropriated the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions for that purpose, that there's a rich tradition of anti-federalism, and federalism, by the way, in calling the Annapolis Convention, in America, one of the interesting facts is that you don't have to wait for the government to call a meeting to have a meeting. You can say, hey, why don't we meet? And that's part of the state and local tradition. And so I think one could put the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions within an anti-federalist tradition, which is part of an American tradition which was established from 1763 to 1798, namely that we can exercise local initiative, state and local initiative, for national events. That is, if you take a look at the Kentucky and Virginia-Kentucky resolutions saying the Alien and Sedition Acts are unconstitutional, and using the 10th Amendment and et cetera, it's not that Jefferson and Madison are saying, hey, Adams, passing Alien and Sedition Acts are not part of what the nation should be doing. It should be what the states are doing. I mean, the argument is not that this is a states' rights argument, states' rights position to pass these kinds of Alien and Sedition Acts. It's an argument that the states, as part of the overall democratic federal network, are actors in protecting Republican principles. So it's not an argument, in my mind, for secession. It's not an argument for one state declaring unconstitutional, but part of this very healthy anti-federalist disposition, which says that localism should be alive and we're going to act on it and invite others to follow suit. All right. I think there are four ways to approach this whole issue of trying to keep the anti-federalists alive. And the parallel is I was speaking at the table and Gary was mentioning the idea of what I've been doing with education several years ago with the help of Liberty Fund, our friends over here. I launched a sort of a personal project to work with high school teachers because I was absolutely, totally upset with the way in which the Constitution was not taught or the founding was not taught. Students were not getting the education after eighth or ninth grade, and yet we're supposed to be turning out citizens. Never mind judges not understanding the Constitution, which is bad enough, but citizens not understanding what self-government was about. And so that's why I launched this program with the websites and with the help of Liberty Fund, working with a lot of high school teachers. And what I was told at the beginning is the rot is so deep that you know, you're not going to make a difference. And I am just so pleased that the rot is not quite so deep, that there's 60,000 new hits a month on that website from high school teachers. And I don't know how long it's going to stick. But what is happening is that high school teachers are beginning to realize that they can throw away their textbook and they can get involved with these original documents and try to make a difference in their own students' lives. And I guess the parallel I'm making is that I would like to be more optimistic than my dear friend George Kerry. That is, I would not like to believe that the Constitution, Philadelphia Constitution, is dead, just like I would like to believe that the future of civic education is dead. I don't believe that. I mean, the results that I have had working with Gary and with Liberty Fund demonstrate just the opposite. Now, I don't know how you measure total success in this age of assessment and evaluation, because it's obviously just over the transom. But you can see the spark. You can see the difference. So what I want to introduce to you tonight is the parallel. That is, if we keep the Anti-Federalist alive, is there some hope that we can revive the Constitution? My point is going to be that you cannot revive respect and love for the Constitution by simply reading the Federalist Papers, because the Federalist Papers have been appropriated by political parties and by the progressive movement so that the separation of powers is virtually neglected, the division between the states and the nation is virtually neglected. And no one asks the question really anymore, are people happier in small communities or are they happier and freer in larger communities? The Anti-Federalists ask the question, are people happier and freer in small communities? I don't understand how we can have one community of 300 million people where a representative is one for 600,000 and still freedom and representation in the same way that we could back in 1787, 1789. I'm not saying that Madison and Hamilton would approve, but you don't get to one for 600,000 from the Anti-Federalists. You can get to one for 600,000 through a perversion of the Federalists. The Anti-Federalists talk about the difficulty of having an imperial presidency. Where a president through using the idea that everything is a matter of war if politics becomes war, then you're turning citizens into soldiers, and you're really raising the questions of friends and enemies. You're not talking about citizens deliberating anymore. And their warning was that the language and character of the Constitution with regard to the presidency contains within itself. See, this is what I think is the great debate between George and me. It's that the younger George agreed with Wilmore Kendall that the Constitution contained potentiality to go in various directions. And I think the elder, mature George has decided that the direction it has gone in is that the Constitution is dead. And what I'm trying to do is to restore the possibility that the Constitution, the Philadelphia Constitution, still has within itself potentiality. It's very difficult to restore, but like education and civic education, if you start here and you start there, you may be able to restore it. But you cannot restore it by going through the Federalists, because that has already been appropriated. So you have to go through the Anti-Federalists. With regard to the presidency, then, the way to do it is to remind people that such things as executive agreements, executive orders, and executive privilege are not there. And that the whole idea of the presidency is to be strong, to be sure, but it's also to be reserved. And George Washington himself bowed to the anti-federalist claim that power in the presidency can corrupt, and he willingly limited himself to two terms. There is an example of the anti-federalist tradition entering into the presidency without even having it to enter into the document. In addition to the Electoral College, which I've already mentioned, but there's an anti-federalist tradition there, and Washington respected that. In fact, his farewell address about no entangling alliances understands the critical anti-federalist contribution, that there's a distinction between the new world and the old world. This is not a Straussian battle between the ancients and the moderns. This is a battle between how you lead the new world and keep out of the old world. The old world is corrupt. You don't go out there and try to change the old world. You try to keep the old world from changing you. And that, in many ways, is the distinction between the Federalist foreign policy and the anti-Federalist foreign policy. It seems to me that we need to remember that message as we enter the 21st century. That is not being isolationist. It is being understanding that there are... Look, I can't believe that the number of dictatorships and disgusting regimes in 1787 were less than the number of disgusting regimes that are in the world today. I mean, how many democratic republics were there in the world back in 1787, 1788? So we were fully aware of the dangers that were taking place. So, again, that may seem odd that I'm arguing that we should keep the anti-federalists alive to save the Constitution, just as I'm saying we should keep Washington's farewell address alive to retain. Because we usually associate the Constitution with Hamiltonianism, and we associate the Federalist farewell address with Washingtonianism, which is Hamiltonianism. But there's a very strong respect, what I'm getting at, a very strong respect for the concerns of anti-federalism in Washington's farewell address. Take a look at the judiciary. I mean, the entire paper, as Gary and I went through this last summer with the help of Liberty Fund, the entire argument of Hamilton and the Federalist Papers on the judiciary is that the anti-Federalist Brutus's claim that once you give the Constitution to the courts to interpret, the Constitution will become whatever the court says it is. Hamilton's response is, it will never happen. It will never happen because the Congress will never let it happen, and the judges will be tied down by precedent. And Brutus said, right, and if grandma had wheels, she'd be a trolley car. So with regard to the presidency, with regard to the representation in the House, with regard to the nature of the judiciary, with regard to the characterization of powers, with regard to the idea that we're becoming more and more homogeneous, with the anti-federalists are in many ways correct. And as my good friend Steve Klukowicz said, when I said I'm going to give this talk on why keep the anti-federalists alive, he said, well, that's so obvious. They weren't ever wrong. Well, they may be wrong. They may be wrong. And no one side can be totally correct. I want to end by these 4 points I want to get across to you in sort of a map. We can look upon the anti-federalists as, first of all, incoherent and irrelevant. That is basically what the Federalist Papers has presented them, and most historians for the first 150 years have also portrayed them as. Their incoherency is that they're taking shots at the document. Why? Because the anti-federalists are defined as those who objected to the Constitution, and any time they could find any objection, all their paranoid impulses would come through, and they're also irrelevant because they lost. That is perhaps the simplest one to overcome, because you know you can lose a battle, but not lose the war. What appears at one level to be incoherent, you don't have to agree on everything. Similarly, by the way, the Federalist Papers were not the only Federalists. And if you take a range, again, Liberty Fund has published this, if you take a look at the range of Federalist authors, they all don't agree on why you support the Constitution. And in fact, very interestingly, some of the leading people on the Federalist side, pro-Constitution side, were those people who entered the Constitutional Convention with an anti-Federalist disposition and were persuaded, like Sherman, Dickinson, Patterson. They were persuaded. Why were they persuaded? Because in the Constitution itself, the Senate, Electoral College, limiting of powers, were included, so they were part of the Constitution. Again, one of the reasons you keep the Anti-Federalists alive is to keep the Constitution alive because they're already in it. Over against those people today, again, like Sabato, who want to rid the Constitution of those elements in the name of fairness and progress. That's not the way in which you're going to save the Constitution. You're going to have to do it through the Anti-Federalist disposition. So that's one approach, that they're incoherent, just random shooting. There's no theory. And secondly, they're irrelevant. They lost. The second position is that they're coherent, but irrelevant. And that's the most popular view of the Anti-Federalists. That's the Cecilia Kenyon Men of Little Faith thesis, that they were coherent in the sense that they had a coherent understanding of republicanism, that is limited government, limited terms, that kind of approach, but they were irrelevant because they were rejected at that time. And so to talk about term limits, says Kenyon in the 1950s, is to demonstrate your irrelevance. Well, I mean, if you fast forward 40 years to the 1990s, the fastest growing movement in the in American politics was the term limit movement. You talk about how the argument of relevance can become irrelevant very quickly. That shows the fact that Kenyon is... So why did Kenyon resurrect the Anti-Federalists? Kenyon resurrected the Anti-Federalists in order to bury them properly. That, in fact, they hadn't been buried because the progressives had taken hold of them. One of the problems in using the Anti-Federalists is that it depends very largely on how you interpret the Federalist Papers. If you love the Federalist Papers, you hate the Anti-Federalists. If you think the Federalist Papers is part of liberal individualistic modernity, the Anti-Federalists are going to appear as communitarian agrarians. If you think that the Federalist Papers are some part of pluralistic collision and colliding of interest group politics, you're going to present the Anti-Federalists as some kind of proto-progressive Marxist proletarians who are not yet existing, but we're inventing it. I mean, it's amazing how the Anti-Federalists have not been taken on their own terms, but have been taken in terms of a continuing argument about people currently having problems and quarrels with the American regime. The third way of looking at the Anti-Federalists is to say that they are incoherent but relevant. And that's Herbert Storing. And his point is that they are... why are they incoherent? Well, he buys the Federalist Papers argument. That is, how can you agree that the ends are legitimate but you're quarrelsome about the means to get there? So that is an absurd or incoherent position. By the way, I would argue that instead of calling the Anti-Federalist Men of Little Faith, I'd call them Men of Little Trust. And the little trust is that somehow that power is can be used, or political power can be used only for good. They were part of that before Lord Acton, that political power corrupts. There is something absolutely corrosive about political power that corrupts the soul of decent men, even though they may be elected by even more decent electorate. There is something completely corrosive. So the real political problem is we've got to watch those people with power and rein them in. That is not the Federalist position. That is not the Hamiltonian position. The Hamiltonian position is we need to give elbow room to these politicians because the danger is lack of energy, not presence of corruption. And I think when I think about the anti-fertilist concern about this, I don't think that they're absurd at all, because sometimes the way to corruption is through the inattention to means, inattention to procedures, inattention to process. Hamilton is the kind of person who says, why are we fussing about all these forms and procedures? If the end is good, let us do it. It's almost like politics is now equivalent to administration. You don't need, I mean, in the hands of people on the progressives and Woodrow Wilson can become corrupted. And through that corruption, we can lead to exactly where we are in the administrative state. You cannot get to the corruption through the anti-federalists. You can, through a perversion of Hamilton, get to where we are. That the politics is that good politics is a good administration, and good administration means having people in there where we don't have to fuss about forms and checks and balances. Starring is an agreement that they are incoherent. But why are they relevant? Here's the real thing. Storing says they are relevant because they had the opportunity to bring back Spartan virtue of the old over against the solid but low Federalist Papers, and they didn't. They didn't have the stomach for that. So they were relevant in the sense that the founding provided them with the opportunity to do the right thing, which was the ancient thing, to provide the ancient solution to a modern problem. That is the Straussian project, where somehow America, to the extent that it is based on Locke, to the extent that it is based on any modern founder, then cannot be defended. So how do you defend it? The only way to do it is to bring some ancient world, ancient back. The beauty of the anti-federalist is that they are thoroughly, wholly, homegrown American. And you don't have to go outside. You don't have to go to Europe to find some model by means of which to locate this debate of the anti-federalist and the federalist. And the final one, which is my position, which is a position I've developed with my friend Bill Allen, is that the anti-federalists are both coherent and relevant. And the coherency is that they have a proper democratic federalism, that they understand that politics should be or ought to be or is local. And that localism and particularism, although it has diversity, doesn't mean to say that it is automatically irrational and indefensible. That liberty and diversity go together. And that in order to protect that, you need a structure in order to protect that. And that they have that. To be sure, there are many disagreements among anti-federalists. But at the core, and the core understanding, they agree. And why are they relevant? Because it seems to me that if you pick up the newspapers and you read about people saying, what has gone wrong with the judiciary, and you read the Hamilton papers, you're not going to get the answer. But if you read Brutus in the Anti-Federalist, you will. If you're worried about what's happening with the presidency and the imperial presidency or glory abroad, you're not going to get a concern for that from the Federalist Papers. You will get that from the Anti-Federalist. Are you concerned about the nature of representation in the Congress and their log rolling and this, that, and the other, and lack of virtue and statesmanship? Well, you may get some of it from the Federalists, but you're going to get it from the Anti-Federalists. If you're concerned about the states and localities being flushed down the Potomac and then not having the wherewithal to protect themselves, to protect localism, that's the anti-federalist. And so to save the Constitution, I would argue that we need to restore the anti-federalist. Thank you.